dissident discourse. It can only be millennial. And now here is your host, Millennial Woes.
Hello and welcome back to Millennial X. Sorry about the slightly late start for this stream. That happens with live streaming in close succession. But I'm now here with Will Tanner. I'm very glad that Will agreed to appear this year. Will, would you like to introduce yourself to the audience?
Yeah, hey everyone. I'm Will Tanner. I write mainly on Twitter and Substack, mainly about a couple topics, the English gentry and peerage, and the fate of post-colonial Africa, particularly Rhodesia, and to a lesser extent the Congo and post-apartheid South Africa, with a focus on the pains that have stemmed from egalitarianism and what some better solutions to some problems might be, whether it's noblesse oblige or paternalistic government policy. So that's kind of my beat. And I write mainly about that and work with a couple guys in a group we call the American Tribune, kind of does everything from e-com to consumer news to the stuff I write about. So all sorts of stuff. So yeah, that's what I do. I just write online.
All right. The Congo is an interesting one in particular, because for a long time, I just assumed that, okay, the British Empire is exaggerated, that the cruelties of that, the atrocities of that are exaggerated. The same with the Dutch, the same with the French, and so on. But I was willing to believe that the Belgian Congo was bad, because I just never heard anything to the contrary. And then about a year ago, there was an essay published that refuted all of these different claims. I don't know, were you aware of this?
Yeah, I think it's on the American Conservative, and it's King Hochschild's Ghost.
Yes, that's it. Yes.
That's the one. It's fabulous. All the stories you've heard about the Belgian Congo are just entirely made up by people who wanted to strip it from the king rather than having any real basis, in fact.
Yeah, it was remarkable. It seemed to be all based on one book that was published in the late 90s by an American journalist. And this essay went through all of it. And even things like deliberately mistranslating quotations from the French and things like that. It was remarkable how brazen it was, how shameless it was.
Yeah.
It's a whole thing. I'll try to link to it elsewhere, but I have publicized that essay because I wanted people to read it, because I thought this is one of those cases where a single essay could have a huge effect and should have a huge effect, because there's so much packed into it. And otherwise, people just assume, as I did, that the Belgian Congo was a nightmare.
Yeah.
But anyway, what you want to talk about in this stream is not that, or South Africa, which we often hear about, but Rhodesia. And Rhodesia is an interesting one because it's not as well documented as South Africa, for example. People, I think, have always heard about South Africa and the apartheid regime and awful in various ways. But Rhodesia kind of fell by the wayside in terms of coverage and people talking about it. And yes, it seems to be, if anything, an even more clear-cut case that you're dealing with two different types of people here, and one of them is very capable, and one of them is less capable. And it's interesting that they didn't even see this in, or at least the leader of the country didn't see it in biological terms. He thought that they could elevate the blacks in that area in time. So it wasn't even white supremacist in that sense. But anyway, I've already said too much. Why don't you introduce the topic of Rhodesia, which is now, of course, known as Zimbabwe?
Yeah, supposedly we're supposed to call it Zimbabwe now, as they say. But yeah, so that's probably what people who know me for. After I finished law school, I started writing on Twitter more because I didn't have to worry about the academic regime. And Rhodesia is really what I started with, and happened to have a thread that went pretty viral and did well, where people might know me for that if they know me. But the reason I focus on it is there are a couple distinctions between it and the other situations. Unlike the Indian Raj, it wasn't particularly exploitative and things went a lot better inside it. in terms of raising the locals up and building something out of nothing instead of just kind of exploiting what existed. And then in terms of contrasting with South Africa, it never had an apartheid regime of note. It had some racially discriminatory laws at certain points in its history, but they were never particularly major. And the main, and particularly under the Ian Smith government, they weren't enforced at all. And the main rights we think of, at least I'm English ancestry, but in America, and I think a lot of my followers are of similar backgrounds, the freedoms and liberties we think of as important, whether it's the ability to own property of any sort, really, and have that be protected by the government, the right of contract, the right to bear arms, right to free speech, all these things that are vague but quite important, Rhodesia protected for everyone. And so you have a really interesting case study in what you get when you have a paternalist government that also enforces the law equally. And it was a pretty good country that people don't remember this, but the relationships inside it were quite good. And the blacks were about as willing to fight communism as the whites. It was a multiracial success story so far as they go, which I think is important and interesting just because we're dealing with that most places now. And I know all that sounds very paused, but I think it's an important case study and something that succeeded when there was nothing there to begin with other than a few pastoralists, and they applied some of the good aspects of modernity while keeping some of the important old things as well. So that cross between old and new, and just the it was known as more British than the British. So the Britishness of it, I think, is really interesting and makes it a great case study for what's important.
And it's also important to underline how successful a country it was. I mean, it was known as the breadbasket of Africa. The contrast later on is quite astonishing. Would you like to talk about that? And well, how it started, the founding of it.
Yeah, I suppose what I should have also included in the introduction is it was this hugely successful country. It was hugely agriculturally prosperous, which I'll kind of get to that history in a sec, but also industrializing. As I said, people were pretty free. So it was the stable, prosperous Western country in the heart of Africa. And now it's known mainly for starvation and hyperinflation. They were recently killing elephants because they ran out of food, which just kind of shows what it became. So it's this great case study in anti-egalitarian, but I think fair policy versus just gay race communism. And so we see where it leads and what exists in the absence of that egalitarian style policy. For the beginning, it was founded by Cecil Rhodes and the British South Africa Company. If you look at a map of Africa in the late 1880s, which is shortly before it was founded, Rhodes wanted to build the Cape to Cairo railroad, which never quite succeeded because of the vast unpleasantness in the middle of Africa, which anyone who's read about the expeditions of Dr. Livingstone can mention. Just a horrible, horrible place. But he wanted to build it, and so they had to get contiguous territory, more or less. And this vast patch of really untamed, unsettled, and mostly unclaimed territory in the middle of southern Africa is what's now Rhodesia and Zambia, and then was just British South Africa Company land that became Rhodesia before Zambia broke off after World War II. And so it's sandwiched between Portuguese Angola on the west coast and Mozambique on the east coast, and South Africa to its south and the Congo to its north. Yes, that's helpful. Thank you. And Botswana, of course. But it's this territory that wasn't really settled. There wasn't really anyone there of note, a few pastoralists. There are a couple ruins from a long time ago that they called the Zimbabwe ruins and pretended was this flourishing civilization. It was not. It was more or less unsettled territory. So Rhodes wanted to build something there. And so he collected this group of people under the aegis of the British South Africa Company, BSAC, and it was called the Pioneer Column. And if you look at, there's an interesting paper about Rhodesian immigration policy that's online. I forget the exact title, but if you just type in that search string, it should come up if anyone is interested. But the point the author makes is that if you look at who composed the Pioneer Column, though few of them were actually gentlemen from England, second sons of the peers, most of them, kind of like those who originally founded Virginia, wanted to be more prosperous and become this landed elite, and saw Rhodesia as a way to do it. And Rhodes capitalized on that when putting together the Pioneer Column, where a lot of the original settlers came from the middle to lower classes, but weren't the rogues of empire. These weren't, you know, just freebooters, whether of the Flashman mold or of the pirate mold. They were more stable people with some education behind them, who could behave like stable, normal people, even in the heart of Africa. So Rhodes put together this pioneer column and sent them north into what's now Rhodesia. He was originally hoping, again, also like Virginia, just interesting crossover, that there would be minerals there for them to mine, particularly gold. The South African Rand mines and Kimberley mines are famous for their mineral resources, and they're hoping it would be the case in Rhodesia. They did find some gold, but not really enough to make it a worthwhile colony. So they were looking at what else they could do with it and realized that the land, if farmed properly, is quite fertile, particularly for tobacco. So again, also like Virginia, I find this comparison interesting. They poured in a bunch more settlers, particularly this was getting to the point of the middle to upper classes rather than so much the lower class at this point, who wanted to buy or settle large tracts of farmland inside Rhodesia and turn it into a stable agrarian colony. This is now in the early 1900s. It was founded in the 1890s. So before World War One, after the 1800s. And they did quite successfully with that. A lot went in Rhodesia's favor for this. Not only is the land fertile, but unlike England or France or places with a long agricultural history where there are all these small fields with stone walls and hedgerows between them that make modern agriculture inefficient and quite difficult to do. Like, there's no point in having a tractor if it's just a 100-acre tract. You need a much larger place for that. In Rhodesia, you could easily stake out 10,000 acres and just go up and down it with a tractor. Obviously, that's oversimplifying it, but it's much easier to do agriculture on that scale like it was in the American prairie or in the Ukraine with the Russian Empire. So they were quite successful at it. They could take advantage of these economies of scale, and the local African labor provided them with a cheap labor source when they weren't just mechanizing and when they needed it. And that's what Rhodesia was for a long time. A few trends in England helped with that as well, namely Churchill and Lloyd George pushed the People's Budget and Parliament Bill, which nuked the power of the peers and really started obliterating their wealth through death duties and income taxes. That got worse as the century ground on. So a lot of gentlemen and peers who wanted to maintain their landed position and these large estates up and moved to Rhodesia, at least moved part of their resources into Rhodesia where they wouldn't have to deal with English-style death taxes that were just highly destructive. The most famous and highest ranking of these is the Duke of Montrose, who served in Ian Smith's government as agricultural commissioner, but there were a large number of people involved with that, relatively large compared to Rhodesia's always small white population. So that gets into the 1920s, particularly 1921, Rhodesia became independent of the British South Africa Company. So at that point, it was still part of the Commonwealth, part of the empire, and had served valiantly in World War One, providing men for the trenches. But it was also independent. It was no longer company ruled. It wasn't like it was under John Company's thumb or like Jamestown, where it was a corporate colony at this point. It was independent. But it more or less continued with its agrarian style or its agrarian focus. Large estates, cattle and tobacco at this point mainly, and a small white population, a couple hundred thousand at most, kind of throughout its history over, and at this point it was even smaller than that, over a few million black Rhodesians. So pretty sparsely populated territory with some great megafauna like elephants, but mainly agrarian in some mines. Cobalt, for instance, is in Rhodesia in pretty large quantities, at least compared to most of the world. So it kind of continued on that track, mining and farming, into World War II, which is when Rhodesia gained a good bit more distinction in terms of the entire Commonwealth on a per capita basis for the white population. It provided the most men for the war effort. Particularly, they served as Spitfire pilots, just how it happened to work out. They were able to put together a pretty large for their size air corps that served in the Mediterranean. That's what Prime Minister Ian Smith did and was shot down in a Spitfire. Was on the run from the Germans for a few months, hiding in peasant huts. I think he hurt his leg or something while he was doing it. So it's a bit of a misadventure that he writes about in his book. And that's when Rhodesia, but just because of its service and because it was noted during the war, started gaining a bit more prominence inside the empire and went from being seen as this agrarian backwater of the empire that not really many people wanted to go to other than those who were serious people who didn't really want to deal with the death duty situation. Because at that point, I should mention Kenya is another one of the British colonies in Africa, and it was where the more disreputable people went. So a lot of the wealthier people who were up for living freely and wanted to be abroad moved to Kenya. So not as much resources poured into Rhodesia. But then after the war, England was a horrible place, of course, between Attlee and his socialism, whether it's the nationalization of industry and high taxes, or just the fact that like London was bombed out and everywhere had been confiscated by the government during the war. So the country houses were falling apart. A lot of people wanted to move, and the government under Attlee was encouraging them to move. So a large exodus of primarily working class people from Britain flowed into Rhodesia.
I should just say as a side note that this gives the lie to the idea that mass immigration was needed in order to help rebuild Britain. We were sending people away to Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and indeed Rhodesia.
Yeah, it's an absurd thing. And it was, you know, British imperial policy, just as another side note, during this period was somewhat ridiculous and poorly informed at best. Particularly Windrush, for example, which is how the blacks first got to England, really, was because the British stopped buying sugar from Jamaica so that they could theoretically get it at a slightly cheaper rate from, I believe, Cuba. And then Jamaica's economy was nuked by that. So people started leaving it and going to Britain, where they're welcomed in, which was a disaster. But similarly, you see like ridiculous schemes in Africa around this time. I think it's Tim Bax, who is a Rhodesian Silla scout. I'll get to him in a little bit. His family moved to South Africa during this period and was given a large grant by the government to try and grow groundnuts in like the desert. And of course, it went horribly and just wasted a bunch of British government money. But you get the impression that things during this period were just spastic at best and didn't really have much of an overarching purpose or goal in mind.
And that's relevant for the longer story. Yes. Because at this point, Britain, I think, after 1945, at the higher echelons of British society, they ceased to see themselves as an imperial power. The idea of being an imperial power suddenly became extremely passé and old-fashioned. Right. So they didn't know what to do with their empire at that point.
Yeah, that's a great way of putting it. They didn't really know what to do with it. So at first they try these schemes, whether it's free trade for Jamaica, which was a disaster, or groundnuts in Africa, which also didn't go well. And they were even willing to start shedding parts of their empire. Primarily, that was something that started happening in the 50s. But Rhodesia, after World War II, was offered independence if it wanted it. Unfortunately, it didn't accept and said it wanted to remain part of the Commonwealth, which came back to bite it. But you see this flailing from the British government. And one of the few good effects was that a lot more British subjects flowed into Rhodesia. So not really the upper classes so much, but a lot of working class people who wanted to make a better life in Rhodesia, much like in parts of America. And, you know, Rhodesian immigration policy, though, was still somewhat strict, where they only really wanted people who would work into the settled system or become part of the Rhodesian culture, which was more British than the British, but also adapted for Africa. So the country maintained most of its flavor while gaining an influx of people who were willing to work, which was great for it. Then things started going less well. The British Empire, as you mentioned, started turning in on itself and things started going quite poorly. Attlee was a horrible prime minister, but Churchill and Eden also did poorly. And so there was the Suez Crisis in the mid-50s. And at that point, the empire started just going to the wolves. Kenya was lost after the horrific Mau Mau Rebellion. There was all the squabbles in India, which I believe left in 48, or was shed in 48, really. Some parts, like Yemen, held on for a bit longer. But the empire was going the way of the dodo. And that was other imperial nations as well. Particularly the Belgians decided to give up the Congo in 1961, which all of decolonization went poorly, with the exception of Singapore. It's really the only one I can think of. But the Congo went particularly just horribly. First, the resource-rich region of Katanga, which is where most of the minerals are, really the only part of the Congo that's of any worth is where the minerals are. So Katanga tried breaking away. This is where Mikor, the famous mercenary from the Congo, he's from South Africa but fought in the Congo, rose to prominence as he tried to help Katanga break away. America said not so fast, and the UN was sent in to stop that from happening. So the whole country just went, just fell apart immediately. And then in 63, and this is relevant, I promise, but in 63, you get the Simba Rebellion, which is these drugged up tribesmen, really. Calling them communist would be imparting too much ideology on them. They were just horrible people on drugs, and they went from village to village and would just kill everyone who didn't flee immediately, and tried to kill many of those who did flee. So they were just roaring through the Congo like a wildfire, murdering everyone in sight. The government's forces were ineffective at best and often just looted the populace and then fled. And so the rebels start approaching some of the areas where some of the few white Belgians in the Congo still remained, Stanleyville, for example, Lupoldville. So my corps is called in to quell it, and that goes okay, but only after a lot of people die. And so because it's just so awful and so many people are dying, those who can flee do flee. And Rhodesia, as you showed on the map earlier, is to its south. And so though Zambia had broken away, and people were able to flow through Zambia and into Rhodesia, particularly the white Belgians. And they come to Rhodesia with these horror stories of, and this is in 63, 64, 65, just the utmost savagery and terror. If you read about the Simba Rebellion, it's really hard to even stomach reading about it. There were famously nunneries, a great number of them, there to help the villagers, and they were just abused horribly by the rebels and in many cases murdered. It's really sickening stories from what happened. And so people come to Rhodesia with these tales of what the natives were up to after like 1 year of independence, 2 years of independence. And the Rhodesians say, well, we're not doing that. We were offered independence and didn't take it, unfortunately. But we are not going to be like the Congo. We're not just going to be murdered by the people under us. Because why would we do that? And so Rhodesia at this point starts negotiating with Britain and saying, well, you offered us independence before, so can we have it now? But now, instead of somewhat sane people in charge, they have Harold Wilson, who I would say is the United Kingdom's worst prime minister. He's a socialist, a laborite, and he raised death duties inside the country to 90%, which pretty much obliterated what was left of the country's prosperity. And in terms of imperial focus, his policy was, he called it NIMMAR, or no independence before majority rule. And so he said, if Rhodesia is going to break away, then that's fine. But first, you have to give power to the blacks. And the Rhodesian said, well, look at the Congo. We don't want to turn into the Congo. And he says, yeah, you're going to turn into the Congo or you're not leaving.
Yeah, it's important to emphasize that. No independence before minority rule and majority rule. And what that means is that the blacks would have equal say in how the government was run. They would have the vote. They would all be considered equally. And what that means is, since there are so many more of them than of the white settlers, that the blacks would have the whip hand, essentially.
Yes, thank you for bringing that up, because I should explain the political system, because this is kind of when it becomes relevant. So for one, if you look at the demographics of the country, it's only ever about 250,000 whites and then 9 million blacks. The internal dynamic is generally quite good, where they get along very well. There's the story from Ian Smith's The Great Betrayal, where his like longtime family servant had a tooth abscess, and Ian or Smith tried to take him to the dentist to get it pulled, and there's all these misadventures ensue. But it was kind of the relationship. They did care about each other and generally got along well. Internally, the country functioned for the government protected rights, as I mentioned, but also it was not a mass democracy. And this is really the sticking point Rhodesia has with the West. It operated on what was really the system in America before Jackson and Britain before the Great Reform Bill of 1832. Where to vote, you have to show you have a certain amount of land or Rhodesian property. The modern equivalent's about 60,000 2024 US dollars-ish, and that's in Rhodesian property. So whether it's a house, a farm, a business in Rhodesia, that's fine. It can't be some globalist corporation. It has to show you're committed to Rhodesia and able to either earn or steward wealth, preferably both, because they don't want the incompetence voting. They wanted the country to remain prosperous as it was by keeping the best in charge. And that applied equally across the races. So white or black, you had to show this property qualification or show that you had gotten a college education, and which was added on later. Originally, it was just property. And what that does is really gave a lot more political power to whites than blacks, but blacks were able to work their way into the system if they were effective stewards of wealth, which served as something of a steam valve for the country in terms of letting off sentiment, because they could just say, well, I mean, if you earned a little bit of money, then you'd be able to vote. So things got along well because of that, and the country was much more stable than it would be as a mass democracy because of that, as we saw with Mugabe in 1980. So Rhodesia has the system that they say functions well and is free and fair, and it's not discriminatory. There's no apartheid. Britain says, well, really it was Britain that led the charge on this, though America was involved as well. And they said, well, no, it's racist because on a per capita basis, whites vote more than blacks, or have the ability to vote in the national A-list elections, being propertied more than blacks. So it's unfair and you need to get rid of it. The Rhodesians refused to do so. And that's really the sticking point that led to this large long-running conflict, because where Ian Smith, despite having negotiated with Harold Wilson for a while, can't strike a deal. So on November 11th, 1965, they declare independence. And it's their Unilateral Declaration of Independence, or UDI. And for one, it's a turning point in Rhodesia's history because it breaks them from the empire. But it's also, they were perpetually naive and trying to do the right thing. So they modeled it after the American Declaration of Independence and said, well, we're a free country that's fighting this tyranny, so we want you to support us. And America, of course, said, kick rocks. We're going to try and murder you because you're racist. Which they weren't, but it doesn't work, or it does work in the independence is declared, and South Africa and Portugal recognize them as an independent country, and the rest of the world goes to the UN. And this sets up the initial fight, because at this point, the Bush War isn't really yet going. There are a few incursions from Zambia, which is formerly Northern Rhodesia, and at this point is Zambia, its own independent country, coming across the, I forget the name of the lake there, but it's where Victoria Falls is. It's this large water-based boundary between the two. And so a few rebels are sneaking in, but nothing really major is happening, and the police forces are able to deal with it. Alan Savory, who's the father of the modern regenerative farming movement, founds the Sella Scouts to deal with it. And they're something like the original Army Rangers, and they're trained in bushcraft and fieldcraft and operate as an irregular force. And they're able to handle the initial fighting, which is small at best.
We should just say, when was this exactly? Is this 65?
Yeah, 65 is really when the fighting begins, but it's on a small scale.
So and it's that's a very, very quick turnaround in those 5 years. It's quite amazing, actually.
Yeah. So it remains a prosperous country, but the fighting starts on a small scale. And really, the initial battle is fought globally is a political fight, because the Rhodesians think that they're going to be able to count on some degree of Western support in their fight for independence. For one, they have some resources that are worth exploiting. They're also the breadbasket of Africa, because at this point they're switching from tobacco to grain. And also they uphold what they think are Western values, but they weren't egalitarian, so it didn't work. The only countries that back them are apartheid South Africa and Salazar's Portugal. Salazar is, of course, slandered as a fascist. Really, he was just something of a Lee Kuan Yew style effective leader. Later, Israel backs them in the 70s, but initially not so much. And it goes along with everything. So this turns into a fight in the UN, where the UN says that they're going to pass sanctions on Rhodesia. And not only are these going to be the first ever UN sanctions package, but in contrast to most now, instead of being optional for member states, it's mandatory. Or to remain a member in good standing of the UN, you have to go along with sanctions and embargo and sanction Rhodesia. Everyone goes along with it except South Africa and Portugal. So Rhodesia is cut off from the world. And as you probably noticed on the map, it's landlocked. So if it wants anything, it has to go through the port of Beira in Portugal. It's particularly where they can import their oil from, because there's no oil in Rhodesia. And what little there is in South Africa is mainly extracted from coal, or importing oil through South Africa is a bad bet at best. So Rhodesia's cut off and decides to start fighting instead of going along with it. Ian Smith tries to negotiate, and this is from 65 to 79 when the war ends, and the Bush War really begins. And so the rebels, there are two groups. One is under Robert Mugabe, and they're backed by the Red Chinese and the North Koreans. And the other is under Joshua Nkomo, and it's backed by the Soviet Union. Both are well-armed, well-funded, well-trained. And they're given moral support from the U.S. and British, and Rhodesia's cut off where it can't really import weapons to fight them or sell its crops on the global markets to earn foreign exchange to import more weapons. So Rhodesia's having a hard time of it, but trying to fight. And critical in this early stage of the conflict is Mozambique, which is to Rhodesia's east, and it's controlled by the Portuguese and had been really since the age of exploration. The Portuguese aren't great fighters. Pretty much any book you read on them, one of the paratrooper units was semi-adequate, and most of the rest were just, if they might be brave sometimes, generally they were horrible fighters and just stayed in their bases. So the Rhodesians start doing a lot of heavy lifting in that conflict. They go in to aid the Portuguese troops and training and help them try and fight, but the Portuguese are demoralized. So it's a long-running battle. It goes from 65 to 74, but eventually the Portuguese lose it because Salazar dies, and then there's the Carnation Revolution, which is when the liberals or socialists, depending on how you want to look at it, take over Portugal, and they immediately shed what remained of the empire, which was largely Angola and Mozambique. And when Mozambique falls, that's a huge, huge issue for Rhodesia, because up to this point, they'd only really had to worry about rebels coming through Zambia. And so if you look at the Zambia-Rhodesia border, a lot of it is water, this large lake, so they can control that with patrol craft and try and keep a lid on things. And what's left of it can be patrolled semi-effectively. The Rhodesians always have trouble with getting more aircraft because they can't really import them. And fuel's scarce, so it's hard to rely on vehicles. So they have to use the Grays scouts, who rely on horses. It's when, if you see those pictures from Rhodesia of men in Rhodesian camouflage with FNFALs on top of horses, that's the Gray scouts. And they patrolled the border and did a reasonably good job of it. Also, the unit that remained known as the British South African Police, even after the British South Africa Company gave up control of the country, is a militarized police force that was involved in patrolling the border. So they're able to kind of keep a lid on things before 74. But then 74 comes, the Portuguese fall in the Carnation Revolution and give up Mozambique. And then that whole border is left exposed and rebels can infiltrate it. And when Mozambique fell, it fell to the communists. I forget the name of the group that took over, some acronym with a lot of consonants. But once it was taken over by the communists, they just let the Zimbabwean communists stay inside Mozambique and train and infiltrate. So the war becomes much more widespread over this much larger border, and infiltration becomes a much more effective rebel tactic. And so if you look at what the Bush War really consisted of, there were a few large operations where the Rhodesians tried sending large forces into either Zambia or Mozambique to attack rebel camps. Some of them were effective, and the Wikipedia entries are crazy because it'll show casualties and it'll be like, oh, 3 Rhodesians wounded and 3,000 rebels killed. So there were some crazy stats, but it was never a solution. And really, it just raised even more international ire against Rhodesia. But the majority of the conflict wasn't so much that, is small rebel groups infiltrating from outside the country and trying to go into Rhodesia and attack the farms. Because as I mentioned earlier, the really backbone of the Rhodesian economy are these large farming estates. So they're exposed. They have generally the white family that owns it, and then they're black agricultural laborers nearby. And often there are some tribal villages scattered about. Now, the black Rhodesians are generally friendly to the Ian Smith government and the white Rhodesians, not always, but generally. So if they catch the rebels, sometimes they'll turn them over to the government or shoo them away or fight them, but sometimes not. And sometimes the rebels are able to attack these families. So the war becomes one where the families will have these bunker complexes on their farms and will have to resist insurgent attacks until a relief force of some sort or another can get there. And while that's happening, the more elite Rhodesian units, namely the SAS and the Sela Scouts, are trying to infiltrate and attack rebel camps. So it's somewhat like Vietnam, except there aren't really so many helicopters, if there aren't really many at all. And there's not really much artillery. So it's much more of a small arms war that's taking place on this very small scale in terms of firefights, but large scale in terms of just territorially widespread and kind of dispersed. It's going okay for the Rhodesians. They can import weapons from the South Africans, but the South Africans kind of stab them in the back in 74 and start trying to turn Rhodesia over to the communists in exchange for more breathing space for themselves. That, of course, hurts the Rhodesians because it's their last real avenue of aid, but they keep fighting regardless. And that's really what the war was. The terrorists would attack the farmers and their black laborers and often just be wiped out. There's some funny anecdotes because they didn't quite know how to use the weapons. One of my favorite is, I believe it comes from Three Sips of Gin by Tim Bax, who's in the Sela Scouts, where the rebels were attacking this Rhodesian farm and they had a mortar with them. They didn't quite know how to use it. So they kept dropping mortar rounds into it, and that would push the base plate farther and farther into the mud. So the family's hiding in this bunker and hears the occasional mortar explosion. And then all of a sudden they just hear this ear-splitting crash and boom. And then nothing happens after that. And the Rhodesian security forces arrive and find that the rebels hadn't managed to adjust the mortar as the base plate kept sinking in. So a round went vertical and landed on them and blew everyone up. So it's somewhat like another conflict right now. It was this Looney Tunes conflict at times, but often quite bloody. So there's that. The Bush War went back and forth like that for a long time. It ran from 65 to 79, but really it was the 74 to 79 period that it escalated and scaled dramatically and became this war of infiltration I was just describing. Important to note is that because internal relationship or relations between the blacks and whites were generally good, most of the rebels weren't really Rhodesians. They were from outside the country. There were various communist agitators that would round them up, train them, and send them in. So the war had this racial tone where it was largely elite white units fighting communist black units. But it was a mistake, I think, on a lot of parts to frame it as a racial Rhodesian war, because the black Rhodesians were largely on the side of the government and or on the side of the locals who employed them. So it was really more of a war of infiltration from outside aggressors rather than an internal civil war. And it just ground on until 79. And at that point, and I'll describe the diplomatic aspects of it a bit, but at 79, the reason the Rhodesians lost was, one, the infiltration attacks had grown so much in scale after Mozambique fell that white farmers really weren't safe in their isolated farmsteads. Even if they had enough kids and laborers with them to put up a stiff fight, they really risked death. And the roads were mined by the rebels, so they couldn't travel much or get to safety, nor could the police have an easy time reaching them. So demographic flight, particularly of whites from Rhodesia to places like South Africa, became very commonplace and was a problem for the state, because that meant that there was a very limited pool of men it could draw on. And the Rhodesian security forces were never particularly large to begin with, maybe 30,000-ish men at most times. So the demographic crisis really hit Rhodesia by the end in 79. The other issue was, as I mentioned, the only way they had really ever been able to import oil was through Beira, Mozambique. Of course, after the Carnation Revolution, that became an impossibility. So they had to harbor what they had left and use it sparingly. To protect it, they stored it at one centralized location. And in 79, exactly what you would think would happen happened. And the rebels were able to get through that one time and blow it up. And so at that point, they lost all their oil. They were no longer able to import weapons because the South Africans weren't helping them anymore. And they were largely out of men because so many people had fled the country. So they had to give in 79, which they did. And yeah.
What a tragic, sad story.
Yeah.
Where of it completely avoidable catastrophe. I mean, it was really engineered, wasn't it? When the UN issued that, the ban on countries collaborating,
sanctions.
That's really a death sentence for the country, isn't it? Because it might take a long time, but it's from that point on, it's just starving for resources, ever more. So, and then other things help it along, help the death accelerate. But it's remarkable. One thing that's interesting about this, and you pointed it out, is that it wasn't internal rebels. It wasn't internal discontent. It wasn't unhappiness with the situation coming from the people actually living there, the blacks, namely. Mm-hmm. It was something engineered from outside. I've heard about similar stories elsewhere where it's not actually, the people are actually okay with it. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's true, but I heard that this was also true of India, where most people were not behind Gandhi. They were actually quite happy with British rule because it was all going well most of the time. Again, don't take that as gospel, but it's something I read a few weeks ago. But it does seem that time and again, in order to destroy a country, you can subvert it from within, and you can have communist agitators and whatever, but it's a safer bet to actually infiltrate it from outside, to train up people around it and tell them how awful things are in there, and that there's a moral imperative to go in and rescue these people from themselves and from their oppressive regime.
Yeah, as you mentioned, it's just all outside agitators, really. It's this horrible conflict where the Rhodesians are just trying to do the right thing the whole time, and they're constantly attacked for it, which is the other like interesting aspect of the war. The stories from the Bush War are just incredible, because it's always like 20 guys fighting off a bunch of rebels and successfully without artillery or gunships or anything. But the other aspect that's interesting is it really shows what the West had become. So if you look at this pre-Parliament bill world, it's one of like hierarchy and tradition, and egalitarianism is looked on as some abhorrent thing that shouldn't exist. But then flash forward a few decades, and at the end of World War II, egalitarianism is the dominating mindset amongst the Western elites, whether in America, it's this push to end segregation and Jim Crow in the name of racial egalitarianism, or in England, it's the intentional destruction of the peerage and gentry through tax policy in the name of egalitarianism. It's happening everywhere. And if, those are two examples I stick to because I kind of know the Anglo world better than the rest. But of course, the communists are egalitarians too. America let Mao take over China. The Soviets, thanks to us, took over all of Eastern Europe. The whole world's becoming this egalitarian place. And the Rhodesians stand as an example of the opposite. And they say, well, we're not going to do what the South Africans are doing because we think that's unjust and wrong and that's not what we want to be. But we're also not going to do it like America's doing because they're flailing. They have internal leftist agitators blowing up their military buildings. We don't want to do that. So, and of course, that's a reference to the Weathermen.
I thought it was.
Sorry, I have a tendency to ramble. But the so they say, well, we're not doing that. So they stand as this example that, of what egalitarian or what the absence of egalitarianism brings, which is good internal relations and societal prosperity.
And just sanity. I mean, you're seeing things as they are, not according to some utopian blueprint.
Yes, exactly. So it's like a realistic society. And what's important about that is that it's a sustainable one. It's not counting on these ideological, these forces of ideological capture. It's not counting on continued just government repression of everything great. It just kind of lets society flourish. It enables human flourishing because it's sane. So that's what the Rhodesians stand for. And they say, well, why aren't you supporting us? Because we stand what you stand for. And the West says, oh, no. We're egalitarian now. And so that's really what you get with this Western attack on it. And so in America, that takes the form of really pushing through sanctions and both Republican and Democrat presidents alike enforcing the sanctions regime against Rhodesia and implying that Americans that serve the Rhodesian security forces will lose their American citizenship. That ends up being untrue, but it's a rumor they promulgate in an attempt to stop the flow of weapons and volunteers into the country. There are a few men like Robert K. Brown, who founded Soldier of Fortune, who go along and support Rhodesia regardless. He has these hilarious stories in his memoir of just smuggling duffel bags full of weapons and banana clips for them because he knew the guy who ran security at his local airport. So they'd just let him put it on the plane and fly over there, and he'd hand them out to the farmers. But generally, that doesn't happen. And generally, America goes along with the sanctions regime. England, or Britain, is even more hostile to the Rhodesian state than the Americans are. It, for one, sends its navy, or what remained of the Royal Navy, to try and patrol the port of Beira and stop oil tankers from getting through. Hilariously, it failed. So, you know, the navy that used to rule the waves can't even stop Greek tankers from slipping through its fingers. But also, it continues to exert diplomatic pressure on South Africa in particular to give up the Rhodesians. And so the South Africans end up doing that in 74. And that leads to a situation where the British, Perfidious Albion, is working behind the scene. And I love Britain, at least the old Britain. So it's not anything about that. But at this point, they are quite bad. And Harold Wilson's government is working behind the scenes to drag Ian Smith into these exhausting negotiations, the only real point of which is to give the communists more time to win. And Smith eventually figures this out, but he's dragged to conference after conference in the hope that some compromise can be reached. And there's some way for the Rhodesian state to continue existing, if with modifications, instead of just handing itself over to mob rule and mass democracy and egalitarianism, which would, of course, lead to communism, as it had everywhere else on the continent it had been tried. The British refused to go along with that, as do the Americans. So eventually...
Here's a question that, just sorry to break interrupt, but to what extent do you think that Britain was acting off its own volition here, and to what extent do you think it was acting under pressure from America or the UN itself?
You know, it's interesting. The only real resistance you see from inside Britain is from the House of Lords. It voted, so when the UN passed sanctions, of course, the member countries then have to internally vote on sanctions or otherwise decide to implement them. So in England, that means it has to make its way through Parliament. the House of Lords, because of Churchill and Lloyd George and the Parliament Bill, no longer had a permanent veto over non-financial matters, but could hold things up for a year. I believe at this point it was just a year rather than the original 2 years. So the Lords say, what do you mean you want us to destroy this prosperous country for no real reason? We're not going along with that. So they veto it. That sparks an internal constitutional crisis of sorts, and the Lords end up losing even more of their power. But it does briefly hold up the sanctions package. But then after the veto expires, the sanctions go through. But really, they were the only ones in Britain who seemed willing to resist it at all. So the conservative portion of the House of Lords, really the remainder of the government, conservative and liberal alike, had no love for Rhodesia and wanted to destroy it, at least from what they said at the time and kind of what their correspondence and debates in Parliament show. So America was undoubtedly exerting pressure upon them to do that, as was the UN and kind of the liberal world generally. But it looks like they wanted to go along with it rather than they were forced into it.
Oh, yeah. I don't think that they were forced into it. I'm just wondering whether they came up with this idea of, well, race blindness, egalitarianism, or whether that was imposed on them. Because it is such a turner. I mean, when you consider the... You know, the Boer War, I think the second one was only, what, 1902. It's not that long. It's not a huge historical gap. And yet it's like 60, 70 years. It's quite incredible when you think of how much the mentality changed among the British elite in that time. But obviously, World War One and World War Two happened in the interim. So that's obviously going to be part of it. But you'd think even then that they'd want to retain what they could of the empire. Whereas instead, it was a complete turnaround and rejection of imperialism and of the British Empire itself. It's quite a remarkable self-dismantling.
Yeah. So I think one distinction here that's important is that, so if you look at most of the British Empire, the British, at the behest of the Americans, really are shedding it and getting rid of everything. Rhodesia wanted to shed itself at this point. They're saying, well, we want to leave. And Britain wouldn't let them leave because of these egalitarian impulses, which is just crazy. Yeah. But I think the anti-imperialism thing was very much an American initiative. I think if you look at internal British policy at this time, you have the 90% death duties of Harold Wilson. You have the nationalization of the coal mines, the steel mills, the railroads. So all these former centers of capitalist prosperity are now socialist things. They're just falling apart under the government. And paired with that, you get the destruction of both the aristocracy and its symbols. So like Wentworth Woodhouse is destroyed by the coal mining board. Or its foundation is destroyed for no real reason other than spite. The Fitzwilliams had always been good to their workers, but the government just destroys it for spite, and you get a lot of that. So I think if you look at the internal, or if you look at the domestic policy of the labor regimes of the period, they were very egalitarian in their approach. And if you know, I think it's from Thucydides, the story of the Greek tyrant who would knock the head off the tall poppies to show how he kept a lid on things inside his island or whatever it was. I really get that impression from Attlee and Wilson and the others of the period. So I think they wanted to do this because they hated that Rhodesia stood as an example of internal hierarchy and paternalism rather than just mass democratic egalitarianism.
Yeah, clearly. And it's one of those, it reflects the mentality within Britain itself, that we're going in this direction. So we can't thole a state existing under our purview that openly refutes this mentality. It's just too much of a contradiction. And so they would let a state go independent, a country go independent from the empire, if it was going to be egalitarian, but not if it wasn't going to be. I think it's quite a hilarious contradiction there.
But yeah, like they'd let the worst sorts of terrorists rule in Kenya and Yemen before they'd let like a sane government full of former World War II Spitfire pilots rule in Rhodesia.
Because the idea that white people are better at organizing things and running things was so offensive to them that they had to refute it no matter what. And I remember seeing, you might not be aware of this, but within Britain, Rhodesia was talked about in the most vicious terms and portrayed in drama. A lot of people know that I have a fondness for Doctor Who, vintage Doctor Who. There happens to be a program while doing Millennial, I had DVDs playing in the background. And I watched this one called The Mutants from 1972. And it's completely a satire of Rhodesia. Mm-hmm. And it's, I mean, it's so distorted. It's so distant from the actual facts of Rhodesia and South Africa that it's amazing that men who probably considered themselves intelligent and educated would spin such a yarn. But mm-hmm. clearly the mentality, I mean, obviously they're in the sort of media arts sector, but the mentality in the intelligentsia and in the arts and media was just completely opposed to the idea that there are any differences between different kinds of human being. And they said there's a line in that, and I think it's echoed in real life, that there, let's say the Rhodesians, it's an alien race in the story, but they say they're going to get their independence whether they're ready for it or not.
Yeah.
And the guy, the sort of fascist white supremacist who's opposing this and wants to maintain his hold on this area, this planet, he says, if you give them independence, within a few generations, they'll die of starvation through sheer incompetence. And that's exactly what did happen in Rhodesia yeah. after it got independence, because it wasn't ready for it. So yeah. It's like you're showing it within these dramas and within these narratives, you're showing what's going to happen, but you're saying that basically it has to happen because to prevent it would be dreadful. It would be inhuman to prevent this.
Yeah. Well, it's like, you know, they always, all liberal policy trends toward just establishing the global favela. And so long as it is the favela, they don't really care what happens inside it, whether it's sexual assault, whether it's murder, whether it's starvation. That's all moral, so long as it's committed by the denizens of the favela. And there's no one saying, well, maybe you shouldn't do that. Like, how about we learn how to read and go work on a farm? Yeah. It's just insanity. But Rhodesia fell because of it, which happened in 1979, really.
Yeah, so to return to the historical threads now, I mean, there's a lot that could be said. I'm using Doctor Who as the example, but that will be just one example among many. And the reason I bring mm-hmm. it in is to show what the native people, the people of Britain, how mm-hmm. how Rhodesia was being portrayed to them at yeah. that time. And public opinion, basically, was being swayed as hard as possible against the Rhodesian settlers, against the white Rhodesians, regardless of how true or untrue, sensible or crazy that was.
Yeah, that's a good point. And just one more thing on that note is in both Rhodesia, or both America and England, Rhodesia was portrayed as this white supremacist, fascist state, which of course was untrue. It always sounds kind of defensive to say, well, they weren't racist. It is important to point out that, for one, they protected just general rights equally. So whether it's property or contract or free speech, it was protected. But in addition to that, they didn't have apartheid laws. They had this voting system that prioritized those who had shown the ability to steward wealth. But that was applied equally. So the extent to which it was a white-ruled state was just because of who in the country were like the effective stewards of the country's future. And that worked out well for everyone. There's these book by an English psychologist. It's called The Mandarins and the Masses, or Our Culture, What's Left of It. His last name's Dalrymple. I forget his first name.
Oh, yes, Theodore Dalrymple. Yes, I've read that.
He makes the point in it. It's this chapter that's not frequently remarked upon by most people who read the book, but he went to Rhodesia as a doctor. And for one, he points out that despite this huge conflict spanning the entire country, the infrastructure was well maintained, where the roads were, like, except for the ones mined at the country, safe and well paved. The buildings were still clean and gleaming. The hospitals were safe and efficient. It was just a functioning country, and you wouldn't really know outside of the news that this war was going on. But he also makes the point that the country was trying to get the, like, intelligent blacks to be doctors or whatever. So it wasn't really quite affirmative action, but they would try and get, like, the talented people in the tribal villages to do what they were able to do. but the various demands of African society meant that they never really got ahead. He makes the point that if you look at the doctors, unlike South Africa, where wages were negotiated based on race, salaries were equal dependent on talent, where as if a doctor was as efficient as a black as he was a white, then they'd get paid the same. But they never had the same amount of money because the various demands of family and cousins and tribal networks meant they were just constantly drained of whatever cash they had. And that didn't only apply in terms of actual salary, but then if they bought a house or after the revolution won, if they had a house that they stole, it would just be ruined immediately. The family would come in and take up every room and just refuse be scattered everywhere. The line about smashing up the wooden door to make a fire actually happened in a lot of cases. There's a scene, it's from a different country, but Africa Audio, they smash up a grand piano to make a fire. And Dalrymple mentioned similar scenes, and it's pretty representative of what the Rhodesians didn't want to happen, but what would happen in the absence of the Ian Smith government. So.
Yeah. I've read that book and his, I read quite a few of his books, but it's a long time ago now. And I don't remember that particular essay about Rhodesia, but I do remember him talking about this. There was one story he told about a grand piano just being smashed, and they'd actually sawed the legs off it, even though they were removable by design, but they'd sawed them off. And so it was, and I don't know which, I don't think it was Rhodesia.
I think it was the Congo is where the piano
might have been the Congo. And it was just sort of sitting on this floor in the middle of what had been a concert hall at a strange angle, because of course they'd been sawn off at different lengths. So it was just like a complete assault on civilization for the sake of it. But yeah, that's one thing that he just reminded me of it with the, when he mentioned the piano, but I do remember him also writing about this. And it's probably the essay you're referring to, that white people who tried to elevate blacks would find themselves, thwarted by the society, the culture that the blacks were in, that they'd come from, because it's a stultifying culture. You can't, individual enterprise, ambition, these things are just not there. It's just not there. And so the relatives defeat the person who's trying to get better, who's trying to improve himself. And so it just ends up with the community sort of eating itself and remaining therefore at a very low level in perpetuity.
Right.
Yeah. It's depressing.
It's extremely depressing, and I'll get to the story again in a moment, but just this is the West never answer. I say the West, really America and England, who are leading the anti-Rhodesia charge, never answered the question of what state would be better, in what situation would human flourishing be more likely to occur than in the Rhodesian state as it existed under Ian Smith. Nothing's ever perfect, but so far as things could happen inside a landlocked country in the middle of Africa that had been a pastoralist plain occupied by a few thousand people up until 1890, Rhodesia was really the peak of what could occur there, and whatever has occurred or probably will occur there, pending large changes. But no one ever asked or answered that question other than those who were naughty. So, of course, it turned into this hellish place near immediately after the Ian Smith government and governments like it were gone.
So how did that unravel? This is something that I'm not, I don't know about this. I'm not educated on this. So the government fell, they admitted defeat. Then what happened? I mean, were white people in great danger at that point? Did they evacuate? Was it orderly or was it chaotic? How did Rhodesia as such disintegrate?
Yeah, so leading up to 79, as I mentioned, a lot of people did flee, and that was semi-chaotic, semi-organized, kind of up to individual case how that happened. But a lot of people just up and left with what they could take with them and what transferable accounts they had. Once 79 happened, which is when the Rhodesian government more or less admits defeat, the country became called Rhodesia Zimbabwe, and Ian Smith handed power to, I think his name's Bishop Murazewa. I can't pronounce those names, and I forget exactly how it's spelled, but it's something like that, like Bishop Murazewa or something. And he was something of a moderate. He wasn't an Ian Smith caliber of person, nor did he really have the old Western mindset, but he didn't want to genocide everyone who was like white or productive. And so that was an improvement over Mugabe. He only lasted for a year, and he was elected in 79, and Rhodesia carried out a mass democratic election that it watched vigorously or vigilantly. I mean, so the election was mostly fair and there wasn't really cheating or anything. And he was elected, and Smith was working with him to try and guide the country into some post-colonial rule. Mugabe, who at that point was the dominant rebel leader, kind of edging out Nkomo, claimed that the election had been rigged and unfair. In the West, America and Britain had really been looking for an opportunity to dial up things inside Rhodesia and make it more radical. And so they latched onto that and said, well, we're going to carry out a fair election. So they sent in, I forget if it was a contingent of Scottish or Australian troops. I think Australian, but I could be wrong. It was a contingent of Commonwealth troops that were sent into Rhodesia, Zimbabwe, to watch the elections on the behalf of Mugabe, pretty much. And this was in 1980. So Mugabe sent his thugs, because he did command a terrorist army, to terrify villagers into voting for him and claim that they'd kill them or chop off their hands if they didn't vote for Mugabe. Naturally, that worked. And so Mugabe was elected in 1980. The Rhodesian state saw that as unacceptable. So a few attacks were planned, mainly within the Sela Scouts and SAS on Mugabe. They had bombs rigged that they were going to kill him with. But the Rhodesian intelligence service had been infiltrated by the British, and so they put a stop to that. And Mugabe was elected, became, I forget if he was first president and then changed the title to prime minister, but I think it was he was first prime minister and later changed the title to president. And he was essentially a one-man, one-vote, one-time dictator. So first, he had to decide how to stabilize his power. So at this point, whites lost all political power in the country, and really most of them left. But there were a number of them, like Smith, who thought that because now the racist state was gone and Mugabe was in charge, the West would work to protect the interests of the remaining whites inside the country, and that some compromise with Mugabe could be reached. It was incorrect, but it's what they thought. So a good number stayed, probably a couple tens of thousands. I haven't seen an exact estimate, or if I have, I don't remember it. But Mugabe, so he kind of had a three-part way of solidifying his internal power. The first step was to wipe out Nkomo. So Nkomo was his Soviet-backed rival, and while Mugabe was a Shona, which is one of the tribes, Nkomo was a Matabele or Nabele. They're both pronunciations are used, which is a different tribal group and kind of one of the original ones for Rhodesia. So it's called the Gurukundi, and that's where, using both North Korean troops and his own rebels, Mugabe wiped them out, killed tens of thousands of them. It's a genocide. Britain kind of looked the other way and said it was fine. Of course, had Ian Smith ever done that, it would have very much not been fine, but it was fine when Mugabe did it. So that point, amongst blacks, Mugabe was the political power. There was no real rival. He then turned to gun confiscation. So because Rhodesia was a Commonwealth country, it had a somewhat different view on guns than America. While farmers could own semi-automatic weapons and use them to defend their land from the terrorists, there were centralized lists of who had what guns, whether it was a shotgun or a rifle or pistol or whatever. So using those lists, Mugabe confiscated all the guns in the country. And that wasn't just the G3s and FALs you typically see, but also shotguns for bird hunting or rifles for keeping coyotes away from the cows. So all the whites were disarmed and most of the blacks were disarmed as well. That was also in the 80s. Things kind of kept getting worse as he did these things, because for one, the competent whites were leaving. And for additionally, he just, whether it was price controls or labor restrictions that meant you couldn't fire people, he was doing more or less like what the labor government in England would do or what a introductory socialist government would do in trying to implement these things. They're all going horribly. And so inflation was ticking up, GDP was ticking down, living standards were ticking down. And then it reaches the late 90s. And at this point, everything's just hellish in the country. Most of the whites have left. But there are a good number left on these large farming estates. And So during the war, most of the farms had switched from tobacco as a cash crop to grain because they needed to feed the country and in any case couldn't export tobacco. After the war is really when Rhodesia, Zimbabwe was known as the breadbasket of Africa because it had all this excess grain to export. Of course, Mugabe then in the late 90s, early 2000s, confiscates all those successful farms, including that of Ian Smith, and hands the farms to his supporters who didn't know how to do modern agriculture. I mean, imagine giving some bushman who's only there because he's murdered a few people control over a 10,000-acre estate with a Lamborghini tractor like that of Jeremy Clarkson and 500 tons of chemical fertilizer and a few tons of wheat. Of course, it was a disaster. They had no idea what to do. You can see pictures where they're like scraping at the dirt with sticks, which is notably ineffective compared to like a harrow. So it goes horribly. And this is when you start seeing the breakdown of things that exist for a reason. So the whole Rhodesian state was organized on the idea that, well, we have these natural resources, whether it's fertile soil with which we can grow cash crops or minerals that we can mine and sell. And so we're going to export them to earn foreign exchange and then use the foreign exchange to buy the imports we need. Mugabe didn't really understand that. So when he destroys the agricultural sector, and at the same time, the mining sector is falling apart mostly, that means that Zimbabwe no longer has exports of note to export, which is a big problem because its debts are dollar denominated generally, and it needs to import food because now it can't grow food and it's not making medicine, so it needs to import medicine, you know, all the usual things that a failing state needs to import. But it can't pay for them because it no longer is earning foreign exchange because it's no longer growing things to sell. So it's this vicious cycle where Zimbabwe ends up obliterated. You get not only the like 50% inflation, which comes because of its inability to pay its debts, really, but also famine and starvation because it's no longer growing the grain it needs to feed the country. And so those two things together are just disastrous. And the country really becomes a hellhole in the early 2000s. Not that it was great before, but you know, Rhodesia in the 1880s was livable. Rhodesia in the like 2000s was not livable. It was just a horrible place. The one redeeming feature is that because the internal system under Smith had been so good, the relations between blacks and whites didn't get better, but also didn't decay to the point that there was a Belgian-style genocide of the whites. So the whites that want to leave typically lose their property and sometimes are beaten up in the process, but there aren't really that many deaths, not to minimize the atrocities that occurred, but it's not really a genocidal exit. It's more of mostly peaceful ethnic cleansing, which is horrible, and I'm not trying to minimize it, but there wasn't this bloody genocide of the sort you would have seen like in the Congo or that you kind of saw in Mozambique had the Portuguese not fled so quickly. So that's the one redeeming thing, is that the whites generally leave rather than are murdered, but the country falls to pieces because of it. Things don't really change until 2017 when Trump tweeted about the plight of like Zimbabwean white farmers or something like that. And then the government, which at that point had deposed Mugabe, agreed to start letting white farmers back in. And so you see some do that. And then this year it announced that it would pay those who didn't want to come back but had their farms expropriated. So it's become a somewhat better place and kind of builds on those existing feelings of goodwill between black and white to try and draw the productive people back in. But of course, because of how things went, that's not really working. But last year, Miss Zimbabwe was a white woman. So there's that.
That was a surprise. But that's a thing in itself. I mean, do you have any theories as to why that happened? Why Miss Zimbabwe was a white woman? I mean, how is that?
I mean, I don't want to comment on attractiveness, but
it's a weird thing.
Yeah, I think the one benefit it has is that relations are pretty good. So whether that was a gesture of goodwill or just because she was actually more attractive than the others, which was also true, it happened, which is hilarious because it's like Miss France is a black African woman and Miss Zimbabwe is a white English woman. But
it's just so ridiculous. You couldn't make it up.
Yeah.
So at this point, as you've said, it's notable that there wasn't that much genocide. There wasn't that much mass violence, mass slaughtering of the white farmers as they left. I know that it has happened, but it's not as dreadful as we have seen elsewhere.
Right.
So at this point, how did Mugabe get deposed? I think that's probably do you know about that?
So he was pretty old, and he'd been in power for a long time, and it had been a disaster. So I think he was deposed in 2017 and then died in 2019, if I remember right. And I think his wife was trying to hold on to power. To be honest, I don't really keep up with it that much because it was kind of once he was gone, doesn't really matter. But the military deposed him at the point where he was deposed. And when his wife tried taking power, they did the same. So I don't, if it is a democratically elected government, that's nominal. And from what I understand, it's semi-military rule, kind of like in Egypt or somewhere. I could be somewhat wrong on the details of that, but I don't think it's really democracy, nor is it a pure dictatorship. It's something approaching an attempt at military-led internal stability.
Yeah, you did have the years correct. He was deposed in 2017, and he did die in 2019. I looked it up there. So, what would you say about the chances for Zimbabwe now going forward? Do you think is there much chance of it attracting many white farmers back, or do you think that that ship has sailed, that people are just not going to do it?
Yeah, so I think there are a couple things in its favor and a couple that are probably killer right now that are against. One is that so originally some of the Rhodesians who fled to Zambia. Many of them fled to South Africa because South Africa at the time was a better place. And now, even with Zimbabwe the way it is, you'd probably be safer as a white farmer in Zimbabwe than in South Africa. So while the Boers don't want to leave South Africa, I think some of the Rhodesian farmers who fled there might just move back because at this point, if they're going to stay in Africa, it's probably the better place to do so, at least compared to the other options. The other thing in its favor is that it didn't have these awful relationships. So I think if you were an American trying to like buy a large farm there, that probably wouldn't go well. But if you were one of the original farmers or like a son of one of them, I can see how the relationships that existed would help you come back and be safe and prosperous, assuming a lack of government hostility towards you holds. I think the problems with that are, one, what you see with that like independent city in Honduras, forget the name, Prospera. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but it was an attempt to build a like independent city state off the coast of Honduras, and they struck a deal with the government to do so. And of course, that went well until they poured a bunch of investment in. And now that they built these new like villages and businesses there, the government wants to just take it. And so there's these legal fights, and we'll see how it goes. But I think that's the worry with doing business anywhere in Africa, but particularly somewhere like Zimbabwe with this troubled history, to put it mildly, is that if you do something there, then at the point that it becomes prosperous again, because right now it's just a hellhole, but say 1,000 farms did spring back up and turned it into a grain producing powerhouse again, I think the worry is you just get expropriation all over again because they'd want to take it for themselves and their cronies, which that seems like a serious fear. The other thing is that there's no deterrence. We're this 1850. We all know that some adventurer would just come in and retake the state. It would happen in South Africa. It happened in Angola. It certainly happened in Zimbabwe because they could. The government is a paper tiger. So you could just send an expeditionary force and then parcel out the rewards to your followers. It wouldn't really be that difficult. But now a U.S. carrier group would show up and kill you if you did that. So it turns into an impossible project because you're suddenly competing with the largest navy, or at least the most efficient navy. I think at the point where the carriers keep rusting and can't get there, you might see that. But up until that point, there's no deterrence between the farmers and the government or the potential white farmers and the government, because they'll always be portrayed as racists, reactionaries, revanchists if they attempt to do anything to protect their own interests. Whereas if the government assaults them, the Western regimes aren't going to care because they'll say, well, that's deserved because you are a racist. So I think those negatives probably outweigh the hope of any real return. But if they went away, which it's particularly the latter one that's troubling. So if the U.S. carrier groups couldn't get there, then I think you'd probably see farmers return, would be my guess.
Of course, while we are so guilt-ridden about all of this kind of thing and hyper about not being racist and checking each other for being racist. The Chinese have no such qualms at all. And that seems to me the most likely future here, that in time the Chinese will just take, they'll just take it over.
Yeah. I think that documentary, I think it's called Empire of Dust, about the Chinese attempt to build like a road in the Congo, it's probably telling. We'll see how much success they can squeeze out of the project. But so long as the Chinese remain committed to it, they probably have a much better chance, as you said, than any Western country, because they're willing to do what it takes. I mean, like, I don't think there really need to be much bloodshed. If anything, it would be somewhat just performative, like Mike Hoare was able to do at some points. But the threat certainly needs to be there to keep anything stable, and the Chinese are willing to do that. And at least when it comes to dealing with these regimes, we are not. But the other thing, of course, is just decay. I mean, that's what you see in South Africa. That's what you see in the Congo. Even with the Chinese there, it's hard to see if they'll be able to reverse those trends without just sending a million Chinese to do the work, which could happen, but would be a somewhat different project than the like original imperial projects were, I think.
Yeah, certainly, certainly. I think one thing that we haven't touched on is how patriotic for Rhodesia the white Rhodesians were. It's, I mean, there's the phrase Rhodesians never die. I think everyone will have seen photos of Rhodesian soldiers, men, militia, marching around armed. They're determined to defend their country, their land. And they'd only been there like less than 100 years, presumably most of them.
Right.
And yet they were very attached to it. In the same way, you know, in South Africa, a lot of white South Africans are very attached to it, and they don't want to return to their ancestral homeland of Holland or Britain. They don't identify with that. They identify with South Africa, despite everything, which is quite amazing to me. But I guess for them, it's the only thing that makes sense. But with Rhodesia, I just want to make the point that they were really committed people. I mean, they weren't just exploiters and, you know, crazed fanatics or crazed racists or whatever. They really seemed to be seemed to have been attached to their country, and that is something that was just destroyed by international machinations, and then eventually by takeover. And it's a shame because there's no reason why today Rhodesia couldn't still exist and be as prosperous as ever. I mean, all of this suffering has been completely avoidable, completely unnecessary.
Yeah. One other thing just on that point is if you look at pictures of Rhodesia, it's contrasts very strongly with the America and England of the time. If you look at these pictures, it's like a vibrant, healthy people who are happy warriors fighting, or if they're civilians, are happy with their existence and proud to be Rhodesians. So not only do you get the Rhodesians never die stuff, but if any country took up the white man's burden, it was Rhodesia, and they're happy about it. And more than that, they were like a vibrant, vital, healthy world. They're not obese. They're not depressed. They don't, they're not just like enthralled the NHS. Whereas if you look at like Britain or America of the time, everyone's like shabbily dressed and looks unhealthy, whether it's from obesity or starving or just general gauntness. If they were fighting in a war, they're very upset about it and are unwilling draftees at best rather than proud volunteers. It's just a, and that's without regarding the like internal violence from dissidents on the left. It's just very different worlds. One is this egalitarian one that's just decaying and depressed, and it shows in the people because of how awful they look. And the other is this country that would be on the up and up were it not for the entire world trying to destroy them. And for one, they're holding the world off. And more than that, they're happy as they do it. It's just a extremely different world.
Yeah, definitely. Well, thank you for telling this story. I think it will be educational for quite a lot of people. It's certainly, I've never heard this story told from beginning to end. I've just heard, you know, from episodes here and there from it. So there are a few super chats. Darby, I remember reading the US Congress was debating the resettlement of a group of white Rhodesian farmers on humanitarian grounds in the early 80s, but Thatcher and Reagan crushed the idea. Is there any truth to that?
I actually haven't heard about that, I'm embarrassed to say. I'll try and look into it because that's interesting. One thing I would add on that point, though it's not directly what was being asked, which I apologize for, both Reagan and Thatcher met with Mugabe shortly after he, or really during the Gurukundi, and both were very positive about him as they did so. Reagan then kind of changed his tune and supported South Africa, but when it came to Zimbabwe and Rhodesia, even Reagan was pretty pro-Mugabe, at least at first. And adding to America's woes on the subject, if you look up Andy Young, he's a civil rights personality from Atlanta, probably one of the more evil men of the second half of the 20th century in America. He was the one who pushed for Rhodesia's destruction. And as Mugabe genocided the Ndebele and as he stole the land of white farmers, Young was always by his side defending him. And even after evidence came out that Mugabe was directly just murdering people, Young continued defending him. So the American political scene was quite hostile to Zimbabwe. But sorry for not answering the question itself.
That's okay. And then Darby also said, very interesting topic. Are there any good film documentaries or interviews with Rhodesian veterans that Will could recommend? A lot of the written stuff is very rare and expensive.
Yeah, so one book that's quite good and isn't particularly rare is Three Sips of Gin by Tim Bax, which I mentioned a few times. It and A Few Hard Men, which is about the Rhodesian SAS, and We Dared to Win, which is also about the Rhodesian SAS, are all, I think, currently in print, and so they're not expensive, and they're kind of my favorite in-print resources on the subject. In terms of interviews, there's one that Chris Cox, who wrote a book called Fire Force, that's also in print and reasonably good, though not as good as the others. He did with, I think it's the Men Among Men podcast or something. It's hosted by the guys who run Fire Force Ventures, which produces Rhodesian camouflage. And his interview with them's good. And Ian Smith, at the time, did an interview with William F. Buckley, and he really dismantles Buckley's viewpoints and Buckley's claims about democracy, and it's quite good. It's not current to our time, but it was current in his time, and it's really a good way of seeing what Smith's views were and seeing him dismantle the Western talking points about his country. Unfortunately, I haven't really found a documentary that's any good. I've been told that there are some on YouTube that are okay, but I don't really like watching two-hour things on YouTube, so I haven't. If you want a documentary or about the region rather than Rhodesia itself, Africa Audio and Empire of Dust are kind of the two that are best on the subject.
Okay. And Anti-Matoid asks, what did South Africa gain by betraying Rhodesia?
Well, long-term, nothing. But if you look at their strategic position in 1974, they had two options. One was go all out in a counteroffensive to try and retain what was left of Southern Africa, both internally and in their fights against Angola, which kicked off in the 70s and 80s, or in defending the Rhodesians, which would be a really large effort for South Africa, particularly considering that it was getting sanctioned and had a hard time producing oil of its own. So it could do that on one hand, which it didn't do, or it could try and appease the West and the communists through a policy of detente, which would involve throwing Rhodesia to the wolves, which is what it did, because it figured that, well, if we keep the Rhodesians kind of alive by providing them with a little bit of weapons, a little bit of oil, then they'll continue fighting and continue drawing the world's ire, but we'll have to slowly drip feed their defeat to the Western world so that they win. And the South Africans thought that in so doing, the pressure would be taken off themselves and no longer would they have the eye of Sauron focused on them. And instead it would remain on Rhodesia, and that South Africa's having been complicit in Rhodesia's destruction would win them some goodwill with the Western world, and so they would get better treatment at the end of all of it. The degree to which that worked out is doubtful. To some extent, they got help from Reagan, but that was against the wishes of Congress and probably would have occurred had they not thrown Zimbabwe to the wolves. And the Western press remained resolutely against them the whole time, so detente didn't really work out for South Africa.
Oh, definitely. I think even now, when people think South Africa, they think villainous, white supremacy, apartheid, and so on. I mean, that's very much the notion that's implanted, that has lingered on over the decades. Antimatoid also asked, what was the most significant battle in the Rhodesian War? And have you spoken to any veterans?
Privately, I've talked to a few veterans, not for podcasts or anything. In terms of influential battles, the problem is that, like, if you're looking for a significant battle that was war-winning or war-losing, there wasn't really one. There's a lot of small skirmishes that cumulatively were effective. If you're looking for one event that was most so, it would be the destruction of Rhodesia's oil reserves. In terms of large operations that were just significant because they were large, Operation Dingo would probably be the one you're looking for. It was one of the ones where the Rhodesians killed a lot of rebels in, I believe, Mozambique. And it was significant, and the couple like it that also occurred were significant, and that they made the world hate the Rhodesians even more because it looked like they were being aggressors and attacking a neutral country, which was, of course, absurd. But it's the narrative that was spread, so it hurt Rhodesia's position. But again, there was no battle that was lost that then meant the Rhodesians lost the war, other than really the destruction of their oil. But even without that, they probably would have lost.
All right, okay. MKNN asked, I heard Will say that there was not really any significant legalized discrimination against the local population under Ian Smith. Is that actually true, or is it a knee-jerk post hoc placation of liberal values?
No, that's pretty true about Ian Smith. As I mentioned, there had been some before him and really before his era, but both because of him and just under his time, that wasn't the case. There are two kind of examples of his mindset that I think are indicative of what he was about and the sort of government he ran. One is that before him, the Rhodesian Opera House in Salisbury, which was their capital city, had been, I forget if it was whites only or if it was segregated internally, where the blacks had to sit on like a higher balcony to watch. And Smith made the point that if it's a point for the point where there's like a black guy who's wearing an opera cloak and is here to listen to the opera, then he should just be allowed to sit where he wants in the opera because that's a civilized person. And so the government went along with that, and the opera house wasn't segregated. Similarly, the Duke of Montrose, who ran the agricultural, I forget the department, but it was like the agricultural department inside the Rhodesian government, set aside half the land in the country, arable land, for black aspiring black farmers. That didn't really work out because they weren't great at farming, but he did try it. And so critics say, well, whites were only, say, 2% or whatever, 0.5% of the population. So really, they should have gotten 0.5% of the land, but that's unworkable because they're the ones who are farming. So in terms of like what it was intended as something that was meant to help the black population. Similarly, there's the voting system, which I described, that had to change. And I believe it was 69 or like 70, I think 69, just because of the demands of war. So they had like a black vote and a white vote that more or less approximated the results of before the change, but were meant to get blacks more involved in the political process so that when the day came that there was someone like Bishop Mirzawa, they would be voting more. So in terms of discrimination, perhaps that was discriminatory, perhaps not. But the intent was to, as usual for the Rhodesians, like lift people up and kind of help them get on their feet and start being more like the white Rhodesians in terms of like societal productivity and ability to deal with things, if that makes sense.
Yeah. That's a very notable thing about Rhodesia. As I said at the start, that Ian Smith, you can see, I read parts of his autobiography, and you can see him saying that it was a matter of elevating the locals, the black natives, because he didn't think that they were biologically less intelligent or whatever. He just thought it was a matter of time. It's amazing that even someone as involved in this as he was, and someone as vilified as he was, even he was ultimately a civic nationalist.
Yeah.
It's quite surprising. All right. And Black Pigeon Pilled asked, a topic close to my heart. Thanks, Will Tanner. My question is, do you place much credence on claims made by Kenneth Flower, head of Rhodesian intelligence, was a mole for MI6? All right, on claims that Kenneth Flower, the head of Rhodesian intelligence, was a mole for MI6. This was stated in the 2011 Radio 4 programme Documents that featured Lord Owen, who stated as much of the old Social Democratic Party.
Yes, from what I understand, he was actually in either in MI6 or working for MI6, but in whatever capacity, he was working for them while head of the intelligence service, as were numerous others inside the like upper reaches of the intelligence service. I think that was confirmed when the CIA tried like infiltrating the country. There was some incident in which it came out in addition to that documentary. I forget the exact circumstances of that, but from what I understand, that's essentially admitted and is certainly confirmed by the evidence.
It's amazing how much the British Secret Service, the British Secret Service is very competent, very good at what they do. And they've got their hand in everything, whether it's, you know, nationalism in Britain, whether it's the Irish nationalism, or even this kind of thing, where they're sabotaging their own colonies.
Right.
It's very difficult to make sense of. I won't say any more. And then Conservative said, we need to get the black vote. Thank you for that, Conservative.
One thing I would add on that front is, of course, they didn't need the black vote, but it did help that they like let the people run their local tribal elections and stuff, because it meant that when war came, those people cared about the government and were willing to turn over the infiltrating terrorists to the security forces in pretty much all incidents in which it came up. Not every single one, but in a great majority of them. So the blend of cynicism with civic nationalism actually worked out for the Rhodesians, which is quite funny. Funny, but like it did kind of work.
It's ironic, yeah. Well, it seems like they did everything right, the white Rhodesians. Yeah. I mean, they were constantly trying to, they were playing fair, they were being honest, they were with the locals, but also internationally. They were trying to elevate them. They gave them 50% of the land for farming. Yeah. I mean, it's just... And they were highly capable people. As you said, they were from the aristocracy. They were industrious. They were hardworking. They were committed. I mean, this is like the best of British people who were involved in this. And then sabotaged by a moribund, dying British empire at home and an establishment at home. It's terrible. And then I think that was all of the super chats. But there was another. There was something I wanted to read out. Oh yeah, from Alan Bastard, on Twitter, and he said, "Rhodesia fell due to Churchill signing Britain up to the Atlantic Treaty, which required Britain to relinquish colonies post-war for assistance during World War II." Read the conditions. That's interesting. Do you want to comment on that? The Atlantic Treaty.
Yeah, like the issue I think with that viewpoint in the case of Rhodesia, or that argument, is that, well, fine, like the British could have gotten rid of Rhodesia at any point. The problem wasn't that they like were too willing to let Rhodesia go. The problem was that they were demanding mass democracy as a term for doing so. And they offered Rhodesia its independence right in the post-war period, which might be where that comes more into play, and the Rhodesians rejected it for economic reasons and wanting to be part of the Commonwealth because the anti-colonial policy wasn't as insane. But no, like the problem wasn't that the British were like, oh, we're going to hold on to Rhodesia at all costs. The problem was that they wouldn't let the Rhodesians leave and just maintain their form of property government.
Yeah, as we said earlier, they were willing to divest themselves of Rhodesia, but only if it was crazy.
Right.
All right. Alan Bastard, he also said that Rhodesian veterans are on YouTube talking to each other, and he lists the channel Fighting Men of Rhodesia. Apparently that's a YouTube channel. I think I've heard of it, actually. Mm-hmm. That's something that people might want to look into. I guess that's it. That's all the questions. This has been great. This has been really interesting and fast-paced, but you've packed an awful lot into it, and you've told it in a coherent way, which is a thing in itself. So thank you very much for doing this, Will.
Yeah, thanks a ton for having me on. This was fun. Appreciate the opportunity.
Excellent. Okay, well, I'll be back soon with, I believe it's herd immunity. Yes, it is. But yeah, this one's been good. It's been an unusual episode, but thank you very much, Will Tanner, for appearing on Millennial X.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
See ya. Okay. All right. I'll see you all soon.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The festival goes on, but how about giving something back to your tireless host? Sometimes the old ways are the best. To send Millennial Woes some special Yuletide cheer by post, you can use the P.O. Box. Address on screen now. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him to keep the lights on.